open the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 508. And Sue, why don't you fill us in? And Daniel Terrell, why don't you come up with Cheryl Boyum while she's doing that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 508 prohibits the Land Conservation and Development Commission from adopting or enforcing rules that impose restrictions on or requirements for outright permitted uses in areas zoned for exclusive farm use. There is a proposed amendment that we actually haven't received yet, but it would replace the original language in the bill and then would allow a freestanding hospice facility and accessory structures not to exceed 10,000 square feet of total floor area to be built anywhere outside the an urban growth boundary.
I just guessed that you two were together. Was I right?
Correct.
Right.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you.
We don't have the amendment yet, which we are going to need before we vote on anything, but why don't you just explain the whole thing, and then when we get it, we'll come back.
From Senator Morissette's office that's here, who might want to come up and explain.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Don, why don't you come up, too? Thank you, Sue, for letting me in. Don Bischoff here on behalf of Senator Morissette, and Mr. Bischoff, why don't we start with you, and then Mr. Clues, or Terrell, we'll go to you, okay?
Chair Vakian, good morning, and committee. Senator Morissette apologizes for not being able to be here. He is attending a conference out of state. Cascade Health Solutions needs a change in the law regarding EFU lands to be able to construct their freestanding hospice facility in Eugene, which I understand may be the first of several they plan. They've been attempting through their attorney, Mr. Terrell, to find a place, a niche in one of the existing exceptions on the EFU marginal lands, and have been able to find anything that makes a good fit. And so they're requesting this amendment to the existing ORSs, and this is a gut and stuff of 508, and I think you have a copy from Mr. Terrell of what the amendments would say, and I'm just here to answer any questions or to help in any way I can. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Terrell.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. The written testimony I submitted.
Just give us your name for the record, and then launch right in.
My name's Daniel Terrell. I'm with the Law Office of Bill Close. We're in Eugene. The written testimony that I have submitted to you includes an Exhibit A, which presents the proposed amendment language in fairly legible form. It adds to the list of permitted uses for both land zoned exclusively for farm use and for marginal lands counties. It's the identical language, and it states, as a permitted use, structures intended for use as a freestanding hospice facility, as defined by the Department of Human Services, and accessory structures elsewhere outside an urban growth boundary. The buildings established for this freestanding hospice facility and accessory structures shall not exceed 10,000 square feet in total floor area. And attached as Exhibit B, because I was warned that Legislative Council may not have had a bill prepared, I did, through the wonders of cut and paste, what we believe that draft bill will look like. So you have those materials before you. When Cascade Health Solutions came to our office and discussed hospice care, end-of-life issues, and what makes effective hospice care facilities, we quickly realized that what they were really looking for and needing is basically the characteristics of rural uses, and that they should be located in a rural environment. Being land use attorneys, we practice exclusively land use law. We took a look at the various codes and statutes to see what are the list of permitted uses. There are fundamentally two routes we could try to go through. One was to try to shoehorn this use into one of the existing permitted uses. There's some fundamental problems with that. First, it becomes very quickly clear that none of those existing uses intended to allow a freestanding hospice facility under that classification. Second of all, each of those uses have limitations that make an effective hospice care facility essentially impossible. The number of persons who are permitted to be there, the number of persons allowed to be employed, et cetera. Then there are also questions related to hospice care facilities as well. It's a highly regulated industry. If you deviate from the requirements for a freestanding hospice care facility, you risk one of two things. One, either losing or not getting your license, or being required to obtain additional licenses and the burdens that are totally unrelated to hospice care. And then the fourth point that's problematic, and for individuals extremely problematic, is it would threaten the funding for patients. We're all aware that Medicaid and health insurance are taking careful looks at every claim that are out there, and if you try to shoehorn in a freestanding hospice facility into another use, it begs the question of, well, isn't this really a room and board facility, and why should we be paying for you to have a room and board facility? So essentially, none of the currently listed uses don't work. The next route is to go through a reasons exception, and in our office, we have a rule of thumb about exceptions on resource lands. If you are heavily developed and you meet the right standards, you can pretty much get a developed exception. If you're surrounded by development, you stand a reasonable chance of getting a committed exception. The rule of thumb in our office is if you want a reasons exception, forget about it. And everybody out there has at least one reasons exception they can point to and say, yeah, but reasons exceptions get approved. Well, they're the exception that proves the rule of thumb. So really, the only solution we had was to take a look at legislative fixes. And essentially what Senate Bill 508 does is it addresses the intersection of two different public policy realms. On the one hand, we have land use policy. On the other hand, we have healthcare policy, and especially the question of healthcare decisions at the end of life period. And really, what 508 does is it poses the question of whether or not the existing land use system is flexible enough to accommodate emerging healthcare solutions. We believe it is, and we believe that the solution is through SB 508. Now, we realize that there will be opponents to this bill, and the opposition to this bill will be largely based upon fundamental land use principles. We can't hide the ball. What we are asking for is an exception to the fundamental land use principle that resource lands should be preserved for resource uses. However, it's your role as the legislature to make these tough public policy balancing questions. And we believe that in this instance, freestanding hospice facilities are appropriate uses for resource lands. And we encourage you to vote in favor of SB 508.
Thank you. Ms. Boyum.
Yes, I am Cheryl Boyum. I'm CEO of Cascade Health Solutions. And Cascade Health Solutions is a nonprofit community organization in Lane County that's dedicated to improving the quality of life and health of the people in our community. I would like to just briefly describe what hospice care is, what a hospice house is, and then just summarize as far as what we perceive the need for these hospice houses are throughout the state of Oregon. Hospice delivers compassionate care to people at the end of their life, and usually it is delivered in their home, their place of residence. This valuable service really focuses on quality of life by managing pain and symptoms while really helping the patient and family members find meaning in the final stage of life. The hospice team is comprised of a group of healthcare professionals, nurses, physicians, social workers, chaplain, oftentimes massage therapists, harps players. You know, these people really work with the patients and their family to provide physical, spiritual, emotional, and social support and care at the final phase of their life. Hospice cares for over half of all Americans who die from cancer. And we are also finding that the growing number of other diseases is also now being cared for by hospice. In 2000, of all Americans who died, approximately 25% died on hospice. And if you look at our Oregonian deaths, it's very similar. If you look at the stats in 2000, the total number of Oregonian deaths was 29,541. Of those, around 8,000 were receiving hospice care. So about 26% of those who die are receiving hospice care. That is growing because of our aging population. As far as hospice houses goes, prior to 2000, there really weren't very many of them in the United States. But since that time, there's been a real surge in the numbers across the country. The reason for this is that most terminally ill patients really would like to die in their home, where they have the support of their family and loved ones. However, there are times when that is very difficult because the level of care that the hospice patient requires more than what either caregivers are prepared to give or what they can give. Also, caregivers need respite care. You know, it's a very difficult task, as many of us have gone through ourselves, to care for a dying member. And they need a place where their loved one can receive their care and give them a break. A hospice house provides an option for these types of increased care, but also the respite, and it provides an option in a home other than in a medical facility. So it is in an environment that provides the care, but also provides the environment of a home that they are so desiring. A patient's stay in a hospice house is usually very short. It's usually 4 to 5 days where they really get their symptoms under control and or they receive a respite for their caregivers. These houses are staffed by professional nurses 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A physician oversees the care. And then the normal hospice team that's supporting the patient is also comes as needed to supplement the care in the home. The architecture of a hospice house is very, very similar to just a normal home. Most of the homes in the nation are actually built, and they're built as a home, or they actually purchase a home and then put the hospice house in that. A major part of the hospice house is landscaping, because what we're trying to create with a hospice house is really a serene and peaceful, beautiful environment. And the landscaping allows the patients to view the landscaping through their windows, and it is, you know, it establishes beauty on the outside as well. The interior looks and feels like a home. There's usually a living room, a family, or a dining room, a kitchen for both patients and family members. And then each bedroom where the hospice patients are in is decorated to really establish a really homey and comforting feel. As far as the need for a hospice house in Oregon, Oregon currently has the lowest utilization of inpatient hospice stay, and it's due primarily to the lack of availability of hospice houses. We currently have 2 in the state of Oregon, 1 in Bend, 1 in Portland. A certificate, actually, to demonstrate the need, the Department of Human Services, who actually grants approval for hospice houses, has actually put in place an accelerated process because they see the need is so great throughout Oregon. They really want to encourage communities to actually build these houses. These facilities have been shown to not only meet a need in the dying patient and for their family, but they've also been shown to decrease the hospitalization in acute hospitals, and thereby it actually has reduced the cost of medical care for both Medicare but also for the families as well. As I mentioned, Cascade Health Solutions is a nonprofit community organization. We actually have 1 of 2 hospice programs in Lane County. Between our 2 programs, we see over 1,000 patients each year in hospice, and that number is constantly growing. About a year ago, our local medical community actually came to us and said that they see a tremendous need in our community for a hospice house and asked if we would take this project on to actually build and operate one in our community. in going out to the community to see what their response is. We've had a very positive response from the community. In fact, we've had a number of very significant financial pledges in support of building this house to actually make it a reality. And so it is our desire, Cascade Health Solutions, to actually build and operate a hospice house in Lane County. The challenge we're facing is that the available property in Lane County is very scarce. When you look at the criteria for a hospice house, we're looking for a location that's close to medical staff, close and easy access for families. We're also looking for a very serene and beautiful setting. Physicians have told us very clearly, don't put this in retail, don't put it next to a hospital. We need that environment that really provides soothing, peace, and tranquility, and that's what we were looking for. We did an exhaustive search in Lane County, and there's just very, if none, property that we could find that would meet our needs and actually was at a cost that a nonprofit could actually afford. We do own a piece of property. It's 3/4 acre. It has a duplex on it. It's right outside the urban growth boundary. It has the surroundings, the serene environment, but it also has the space and it's easy access. It's within 5 minutes to many medical practices, very easy access off freeways, major roads to get it. The challenge we have is the property is zoned as exclusive farm use. An EFU zoning, as Dan mentioned, does allow some special use permits. And so we did an exhaustive search of would any of these fit our need. The one in particular that was constantly brought up to us was it could be licensed as a residential care facility. In looking through reading the state statute, but also in multiple conversations with the Department of Human Resources, who actually licensed both residential care facilities and hospice houses, we all agreed that this was not the best fit. As Dan mentioned, there are really two main issues with that. One is that the requirements of a license for a residential care facility really does not meet the needs of short-term hospice end-of-life stays. It's really geared to more people living there full-time, and it actually would put requirements on us that would make it difficult for us to operate and actually add to both our building expense and our operational expenses and really limit the focus of what we were able to do. The other one, which is just as important, is that it would threaten our ability to actually receive Medicare funds, which most of the people that are on hospice are Medicare, and it would be very difficult to not have some of these funds available for us. So in summary, given the growing need for hospice houses in Oregon and the scarcity of land available, we would like to respectfully ask that you would approve the proposed amendments to the land use statutes that will allow us to build a freestanding hospice on farmland that's zoned EFU. The underlying philosophy of a hospice house is to provide compassionate care and support for the dying patient, and to do that in a quiet, respectful, and beautiful environment. As a result, we believe a hospice house would nicely blend with the farmlands of our state. The presence of this home would have minimal impact on neighbors, on the landscape, and the overall environment of the surrounding properties. And I believe that it's also a wonderful option for those patients and their families who have a dying person, and one that I think all of us, if our loved one was in need of this, would really appreciate. So I would like to just thank you for your time and thank you for your serious consideration of this.
Any questions? Nope. Thank you three very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Don Schellenberg and Kate Kimball. That'd be a nice addition.
Let's give some more.
Just for you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Here we go again. Just 3 days ago, I described to you the purpose of land use planning, and the purpose of the AFU zone. The AFU zone is called the exclusive farm use zone. That's what it's designed for. That's what it's used for. That's its purpose. And there are many reasons why that is the case. And I went through those with you just on Tuesday, so I'll not do that again. I do have that incorporated, however, in my testimony, and you can read that at your leisure. Today I want to focus on the fact that the EFU zone is an industrial zone. We do everything and more than what they do in an industrial zone. The only difference is, in an industrial zone, those activities are confined by walls. In the EFU zone, they are not. They're out and wide open. This is the harshest environment for the most fragile human beings. These are not compatible. As we learned from the spokesman from the Association of Oregon Counties during testimony on Senate Bill 772 in this committee on Tuesday, there are rural industrial zones located all over Oregon. A rural industrial zone has many of the features that I believe these folks are looking for. As far as being an industrial zone, at least the activities that occur around that area are inside the walls. If they were to site hospice facilities in EFU zones, and they think they have an ideal situation, because this is an exclusive farm use zone, there's no guarantee that a large animal operation with 1,000 head of animals, odor, dust, noise 24 hours a day, equipment moving around daily 24 hours a day, there's no reason to believe that that couldn't be sited next door, which would then ruin the serenity that they had moved there for in the first place. Again, the farm belongs in the farm zone. That's why it's called the exclusive farm zone. Hospice facilities belong in the urban growth boundary, or if a more rural setting is desired, then the rural industrial zone would be the more appropriate place. But inside the urban growth boundary, they have medical services, they have water, sewer available, all of those issues that are necessary for a hospice facility to operate are readily available and nearby. Those are not available in the EFU zone. The Oregon Farm Bureau asks that you reject these amendments and keep the exclusive farm use zone as an exclusive farm use zone. Thank you.
Let me ask you something about that, which in my question is not meant to be a combative one. It's really just curiosity. There's so many exceptions to the EFU lands now. It almost just seems ridiculous to not, and I don't know what we're going to do with this bill yet, but it almost seems ridiculous to cut it off right before hospice care when you've got, I don't know, what are there, 40 or 50 exceptions to farm use land now?
Mr. Chairman, Don Schoenberg, that is correct. There are 50, at least 50 listed permitted and conditional uses. And, you know, you're saying it seems strange to just cut it off now. Yeah, we would like to cut it off a long time ago.
I know. Yeah,
and, in
I
fact, we have bills that will remove some of
yeah,
those.
I know.
We have very limited resources in the EFU zone. We're losing land. We're losing water to these non-farm uses. That hurts our infrastructure. It's key. It's that we not continue to do this kind of thing, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I'd like to follow up that question if I could.
No, go right ahead.
Hospice services are starting to fill a bigger niche in health care now, and a very compassionate one, very appropriate one. We're having fewer and fewer people die in hospitals, more people dying at home. Oregonians have a special special attachment to our lands and our state. Probably half the people in the state I consider rural. And many of the people that I see die every day would, I think, like to have something like this. It was properly sited and carefully done. I can't imagine hospitals ever taking up any significant amount of land, any significant amount of farmland. And I can't imagine them siting something in an area that would ever be considered a problem. You can kind of predict a lot of that, not perfectly, but a lot of it. I don't think we'd probably ever see more than 6, 7, 8 of these across the entire state ever done. Yet I also understand your concern about what's happening to farmland in our state, especially in my valley. And I'm much more concerned about, not hospice, I'm worried about urban growth boundaries going crazy. I've watched 500 or 600 acres Bishop turned into a golf course and into 1,300 residential homes a mile away from my office that used to be farmland. That, to me, is a much bigger danger. This hospice situation, to me, is just a little sliver that I would like to consider at least the possibility of giving people, especially people who have lived in the country all their lives, a chance to die where they want to die. I have patients who have lived in farms their lives, and they are facing the last few months or few weeks of life. They don't want to be in a hospital. They don't want to be in the city. But they're just a little need a little more than they get at home. And for them to be able to be still out in a farming area so they can die would be a small blessing for them. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this, Bill, because I do understand your position, too. But there's some compassion here we have to think about. And I mean, if I was going to make a case for an exception to this, this is probably the first one I'd make. And I'm going to have to think about this a bit, and I'd ask you to think about it, too. This is a very small, tiny, tiny footprint of what we're talking about. These people are dying.
Chervakian, Senator Bates, I understand what you're saying, certainly. And if I could suggest to you again that the rural industrial area would be most appropriate for that. It has all of the serenity because it's out in the rural area. They're usually not a built-up area. There may be one or two, maybe. Maybe there's none. Manufacturing or businesses in those industrial areas, but they're out there available. That would be a much better situation for this kind of use. And again, I would remind you that this is an EFU zone, and while the current situation when they site there may be ideal, there's nothing that would guarantee that it will be ideal 2 weeks later.
Okay, we need to keep moving on. And I'm sorry, but I don't know who you are. You came up with these two. I assume you're with them.
Mr. Chair, I got here, wrapped to the sign-up sheet, and disappeared. I'm Ron Eber with the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Oh, okay. Well, good. You want to say something with respect to what Mr. Schellenberg just said?
If I might, Mr. Chair. I have some of the same concerns that Mr. Schellenberg has about farm zones, and the department supports that and has concerns about the Dash 1 amendments. What I would add is I'm not unmindful of the need for hospice care. My father was in a hospice here in Salem. He was in a home in a residential neighborhood that looked like any other home in the neighborhood, and it provided excellent care. What I would add to what Don was saying is that there is a large amount of rural residential zoning in the state, and I'm aware in Lane County there's in fact more rural residential zoning in Oregon than the land inside urban growth boundaries. There's almost 900,000 acres in rural residential zoning, so there is land in rural areas that's appropriate for this type of activity that's not in a farm zone that is readily available. I would also point out that there is an existing provision in the exclusive farm use zone that allows someone to provide room and board arrangements that, as a land use matter, is broad enough to cover the approval of a hospice activity. And it just has to be in an existing residence. And as you heard, the proponents of this measure have an existing duplex or dwelling on the property, and it probably could be remodeled and used for that purpose. So, again, we have the same concerns. This is a use that, although it's an important use, we don't believe is appropriate within an exclusive farm use zone. If you look at the other uses that are already allowed in the farm use zone besides farming, a good deal of them either are things that need to be and actually require a rural location. They are either directly related to farming or in some cases have grandfathered in pre-existing uses from that predated the zoning.
Let me ask you a specific question, and then we're going to need to move on because we've got other bills to hear. Does the language in the amendment anywhere outside an urban growth boundary give you any concern? The amendment doesn't speak specifically to EFU land. It speaks to structures located anywhere outside an urban growth boundary.
Chair Abakian, that's broad language, but by virtue of where the amendment is being made in Chapter 215, it ends up being an authorization only in exclusive farm use zones.
Okay, thanks.
There's nothing in state law that would preclude a hospice from being allowed in a rural residential zone.
Okay. Morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kate Kimball, and I'm staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. Chairman Abakian and members of the committee, I don't think this is a question about whether or not hospices are a good idea. When the legislature is not in session, I volunteer as a chaplain, and I strongly believe in hospice and the care that it provides. Where I think the disconnect is you heard testimony this morning about hospice in a serene and peaceful area. And I know as I drive by farmland, it sure looks peaceful, but I also know what goes on in those pastures and fields. And it's not peaceful. It's not serene. If you think, well, in this case, maybe it's serene, what this authorizes is hospices around the state. And at the same time, that takes away counties' abilities to site those hospice facilities because it's considered a sub-1 use. It's an allowed use, not a permitted use, subject to county restrictions. So, for example, in eastern Oregon, if a county decided that a hospice facility does not belong on rangeland, which would be a reasonable conclusion in my opinion, this bill as drafted would give the county no authority to do that. So I urge you to consider that hospice facilities, the need for serene and peaceful surroundings, of course we understand that. EFU land just isn't that kind of surrounding.
Okay. Questions? None. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else here that want to testify on 508? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 508. I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 812. Sue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 812 modifies laws governing people's utility districts, and there is an amendment, a dash one, that replaces the original bill language with language that would update statutes that govern people's utility districts in order to facilitate the ability of PUDs to acquire new renewable energy sources. The changes ensure that PUDs may partner with other utilities and private entities that have the facilitating tool and have the facilitating tools that will be needed to acquire new renewable energy resources.
Right. Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Goddard, come on up. Go right ahead. Whichever one of you wants to start your bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard, represent the 6 Oregon PUDs in the state. PUDs are unique in that all of our authority comes from statutes from the legislature. Co-ops and IOUs, PG Pacific Corps, are private businesses and have broad authorities. Municipal utilities have city charters. Our statutes are out of date. They refer to things like uranium processing and enrichment that is 30-year-old kind of stuff. Our members will be turning to renewable resources for their future. We ask our attorneys, what is it we need to do to upgrade our statutes to be successful in acquiring new resources, renewable resources? what's in Senate Bill 812-1 amendments as a result of their work. We took these issues to the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group and said that if an RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard, is going to be developed, we need the tools to be successful with it. They supported our changes. They worked their way through the process. Some but not all of these provisions are in the Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Portfolio Standard. Some major provisions were deemed not to fit within the relating clause and so are not included there. These are changes that we desire and need regardless of whether the Renewable Portfolio Standard passes. There's a separate discussion going on about that. We have our own issues with that. We're grateful for the changes that were included in it, but we need this bill because we don't know what's going to happen with 838, and our members are going to proceed with renewable resources in any circumstances. I can talk about the details of what's in here more than you would want to, so let me just say in summary form, these changes have to do with our ability to partner with other entities in the new business models that are driven largely by the federal production tax credits and our ability to finance those kind of projects. And again, just by brief summary of how these differ from what's in 838, there are two provisions that I mentioned that were not included there. Those have to do with our ability to use what's called the Uniform Revenue Bond Act that's in ORS 288 and our ability to participate in rural renewable energy development zones in ORS 285. Those are additional provisions that aren't in 838. There are two other changes that have been requested by other utilities. PUDs have particular authorities that other utilities worry about and they want protection from. We know that that's an area we don't want to go into because we won't be successful if they feel like they're threatened in any way. We think the changes that are my members desire me to communicate to you that the changes that they propose, they believe are unnecessary, yet they're in the bill and don't interfere with our ability to achieve what we want to do. So we're asking for your support of 838-1 amendments today. Thank you.
Anything to add?
Good morning, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy with Portland General Electric. Don has been very good to work with on this issue, notwithstanding his members' belief that the changes are unnecessary. PGE has a long history of having interacting with PUDs, and sometimes it's not always been the most friendly history, and gets concerned whenever there's language in statute that may indicate a broadening of authority, especially relating to condemnation, and especially when that condemnation authority looks like it relates to our distribution assets. We are happy with the language the way it is in the dash one amendments, and we have no concerns about it anymore. So,
all right, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification, Don, you were speaking specifically about 285 and 288 and the amendments in those two chapters. Yet, that's the way I read it, that's chapter or section 17 and 16 of the bill, I believe, of the proposed amendments. And the rest of the amendments seem to be dealing with chapter 261 through, I guess it's all, pretty much all 261.
And 262.
Okay. So, if you were speaking about 261 and 260, or if you were speaking about the last two sections of the bill, what's all the language in the first 15 sections for?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Beyer, these are changes in a broad sense that are necessary under new business models that renewable energy resources will be developed. These other provisions, 261 and 262, are in 838. I didn't mean to glance over them, but I was just making a distinction of what's in 838 and what is not.
Thank you. That answers my question somewhat. But where is Senate Bill 838 right now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, it's passed the Senate, and hearings are being held in the House Energy and Environment Committee.
So if we have issues in 838, why are we trying to fix them in Senate Bill 812?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, my reasons are because these two provisions in 285 and 288.
I understand that.
Okay.
But why are sections 1 through 15 in this bill if those same sections are being amended in a bill that's currently being worked on in the House?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Byers, because this is a standalone bill that deals with all of our issues, we don't know what will happen with 838, and we want these changes regardless of the outcome of 838. And then additionally, 838 doesn't include the PGE change and the co-op change.
I understand that, but those sections of the bill are in 838, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that's correct.
And this issue, well, maybe I should be asking these questions to Brendan. These issues were being brought forward by things that are in 838.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there are a number of issues, as Don has pointed out, that are in the Dash 1 amendments, which are additional changes to clarify the PD authority to engage in renewable projects. I think that's an accurate statement, and we support all of those changes. There is language in that PGE is interested in and cares about in Section 6 of the Dash 1s. Which, although is similar to the underlying language in Senate Bill 812 and also similar to language that is currently in Senate Bill 838, we believe is ensures that if PUDs are partnering with LLCs or with electric cooperatives to engage in acquiring facilities for energy production, that the condemnation authority is restricted and ensures that they cannot use that to acquire our distribution assets, which we're most concerned about.
I guess let me just ask a question directly, if it's okay, Mr. Chair. If there's problems with 838, why are you running another bill to fix it? Why aren't you fixing those problems of 838 in 838?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, those things just aren't within my control. There are other things in 838 that the PUDs would like to change. We'd like to have the 1995 date for eligible resources changed to 1991. We would like to have non-firm hydropower recognized, and we would like to have the threshold for the 25% standard increased to 3% rather than the 1.5%. We've made those arguments in this committee and weren't successful. We're making those on the House, and who knows what's going to happen. Yeah, there are changes we'd like to have to 838, but this is the place where we're looking for the authorities to be upgraded to allow us to go forward with renewable resources regardless of the outcome of 838.
Well, and again, this isn't a question. I guess this is a comment. But this is a bicameral legislature, and 838 passed this chamber, passed this committee, passed this chamber. It's now in the House. It's in committee. It's being worked today. There are issues in the bill. Why are you not over there working that bill? Instead, why are you running a separate bill or looking to amend a separate bill? And again, this isn't a question. This is a comment. I don't understand why in a bicameral legislature we're not working both sides of the process. And if there are reasons why, I wish you would state them for the record.
I think you said it was a statement, not a question. So, thanks. Any other questions, committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Hi. My only question is we don't know the outcome of 838 yet. Do you perceive that anything in 812 will end up conflicting with 838 since we're talking about the same statutes? And if so, what should the process be? I mean, should we wait for the final language in 838 that gets voted off the floor and be ready to move 812 if they complement each other and don't conflict with one another? I'm afraid that if they conflict and we've got two bills out here, floating around, the conflict with one another.
Turn to answer that one.
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, the only real conflict between Senate Bill 812-1s and 838 are in Section 6. All of the other changes can be made side by side and then through the LC process and codification be resolved. The language in Section 6 in the 812-1s and the language in Section 35 of 838 do conflict. If they do both move, it will be necessary to have a conflict amendment drafted, and we would probably do that in the second house to Senate Bill 812.
Mr. Chair, do you have any sense of how soon 838 is going to be finalized over on the other side? Do you have any sense of that at all?
Yeah, it's going to move very quickly. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the conflict and talk a little more specifically about what you just said. What's the conflict, and have you discussed this with LC? And is everybody on board with procedurally how to handle that?
Mr. Chair, yes, I have discussed that with LC, and everyone there is on board with how to handle it. It will be flagged for the conflicts team in LC so that when both bills do move forward, they will have that amendment ready to go. The conflict itself is that the new language in Section 6 in 812-1s and all new language in Section 35 of 838 are not exactly the same.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So if they were both to pass, there would be two brand new sections adopted by the legislature, which would be contradictory to one another. So we would want to resolve that before that moved forward. And typically in a conflict situation, it's to an existing section, and you're trying to amend similar language in an existing section. And in this case, it's a little bit different, but the conflicts process moves the same way. If both bills are seen to pass before the second bill passes the second house, a conflicts amendment would be put in. The last way to resolve it, if all else fails, would be a last passed rule, and then at that point in time, Senate Bill 812-1, as far as Section 6 was concerned, would control.
You, of course, have the benefit of having been downstairs doing this kind of thing before, as well as sitting in this seat. Now, this is something that you always try and avoid, but not something that is unheard of, right?
Senator Bakken,
conflicts amendment process.
That's correct. The conflicts amendment process is well used, well utilized.
Okay. Any other questions? The one statement I'd want to make for the record is I do fully appreciate Senator Byer's comments, but at the same time understand that in this building there are numerous procedures that can be used for getting a bill through, and all of us have used them in any number of circumstances, and amending a bill or putting through another bill are both perfectly acceptable procedures for passing laws. And what we just need to make sure is that conflicts process works properly when we get to that point. All right. Seeing nothing else, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 812. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 812. And would like a motion on the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones amendments into Senate Bill 812.
Senator Bates moves the dash ones into 812. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted. And on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 812 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bates moves 812 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I will support the motion, the bill going forward. I think it is evident that there's something going on behind the scenes that when you have a problem with a bill, everyone knows the problem with the bill, and the bill is scheduled for work session in the other chamber, and yet people who recognize the problem are not allowed to put amendments into a bill. It tells me that our bicameral process maybe not is not working the way that our founders had intended the bicameral process to work.
And even though no one would say for the record why that is, we all know why that is.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, if this was not a sort of a time-sensitive point of the state legislature, I would ask this bill be held for a couple of weeks while we find out what happened to 838 and exactly what it says, and then fix it here before we send it across. I know that we have to move bills out, and I don't frankly know what Senator Clark is talking about, and I'm going to have to find out later. But I think we're probably making some sausage here, but hopefully it'll taste good when we get done. And because of the time sensitivity of it, I'm willing to vote this bill out and vote it across the floor and get to the House, and with the understanding that it is a bicameral process, and I trust my colleagues on this side of the building that when 838 is completed, they can take care of the conflict in this bill, and it will complement 838, not be in conflict with it. I would like to see them just change Section 6 as an example of Section 6 of the part that's in conflict, change 812 over there and bring it back for a consensus. It would seem to be something that's rather straightforward and can be done. But for right now, I think we're on a timeline that if we're going to do anything, we're going to have to move this forward.
Mr. Chair, I'm respectfully going to dissent and vote no on the bill, just out of the fact that we've got so much invested into 838. Quite honestly, I don't remember People's Utility District bringing these up to me during the discussions of 838, which we spent 7 weeks working on. So I'm just a matter of how much we've got invested, I'll dissent.
And with respect to your comments, Senator Byer, too, I don't have any idea what you're talking about either. And I think it's a very difficult statement for you to make that there are things going on behind the scenes when you've got two very public processes going on in both chambers regarding these issues. 838 was an extremely complicated bill, and there may be amendments that are made on the House side, and they're having full public hearings on those things now. Additional issues were brought up by these folks, and this is under the rules of both chambers an acceptable method for passing the bills. And we have an acceptable method for handling conflicts when both chambers are working on similar issues through legislative counsel, all a completely public process. So with that, I thank the both of you for at least bringing the issue forward and giving us a way under our rules and laws that is acceptable for getting the conflict managed. With that, objections?
Yes.
Atkinson objects? Motion carries. Avakian will carry 812. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 812. And we'll stand at ease for just a minute. I'm going to open up an extremely brief public hearing on Senate Bill 165. And Ms. Knight, if you want to come up, just to actually, you know what? Actually, you don't need to come up. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 165. And Sue, can you just tell us what the new amendment is? And Ms. Knight, it's not fair for folks to be chuckling at the dais when there's a bill that's very important to you.
I'm sorry.
You remember there was concern about it moving to $10,000, and you have an amendment that changes that, moves it to $5,000, I think, is that the amendment does. So Sue's going to tell us what the amendment is, but just to let you know, I have no idea what the committee is going to do. We're going to take a vote and see what happens. Sue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 165 just briefly expands the State Board of Geologist Examiners' authority to investigate complaints. There is a dash one amendment that reduces the maximum penalty from the $10,000 that was suggested in the bill to $5,000.
It's the chair's intent to move this thing to a vote right now. The chair is going to vote yes on the bill. I know that there will be some dissent. I had Ms. Knight submit, or maybe I got it from LC, a list of what the penalty provisions include for other similar boards and commissions. They ranged anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000. $5,000 seemed to be darn near the median amount for other boards and commissions. Any other discussion?
I apologize to you.
All right. Thank you. Matt, let's do a roll call on this one.
Do you want to do the dash one amendment?
I'm sorry, we do have the amendment, don't we? Okay, could somebody move the amendment for me?
Move the dash one amendment, sir.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson moves the dash one amendments. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted. And on the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill
165
as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Prozanski. Moves Senate Bill 165 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I
Senator
Byer. Quietly vote no, but I do have to point this out. Everybody has to recognize that this bill is retroactive. So this, as drafted, this bill is a retroactive bill. So if you look down in line 39 through 41, section 4 of the bill applies to this act and before, on, or after the effective date of this act. This is a attempt to go after someone retroactively.
Mr. Chair.
That is an important point. Senator Prozanski.
Yeah, I would assume that the limitation there would be if there is an ongoing investigation that has not been resolved and some type of discipline has already been administered, that would apply to those situations as compared to something that has already been resolved and final orders have been issued.
I think it would have to be that way. I think there would be a constitutional preclusion.
I agree.
To apply it in any other way. All right, Matt, could you do the roll call?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Bates?
No.
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Prozanski?
Aye. With vote explanation.
And Senator
Lockheed? Aye. And with that, the motion fails.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, my vote explanation is that this is something I think is serious. We do need to allow for these regulatory agencies to be able to have, let's say, sufficient sanctions to hold individuals accountable when they are causing really the public a lot of issues. In fact, could cause them a lot of financial cost for doing inaccurate work, inappropriate, etc. Regarding the concern that Senator Byer raised, that was one of those issues that I was willing to move the bill forward due to the time frame that we had and allow the House to make any modifications based on hearing testimony of how it can apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Prozanski. I close the work session on Senate Bill 165.
And before you close the committee. Mr. Chair, I understand Senate Bill 508, their amendments were not available this morning. I'm asking that be continued to this afternoon's docket or agenda. So if the amendments are out before this afternoon when we meet, that we will be able to consider that for work session.
I will try to accommodate that this afternoon. If not, we'll schedule as soon as we possibly can for you. And
so that will be carried over to this afternoon to allow for that if it's possible. I just want to make sure that
correct
the record.
Correct.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned. Ms. Knight, do you have just a minute?